Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We often start with emails on the show, and I'll start with maybe the shortest one yet. And it's from a listener named Ernie who said, I think the word you were looking for in our last episode was tedious.
And what he was responding to, Ernie, I was looking for a word when we were interviewing the archaeologist because I was trying to think about whether his job, Ben's job, is boring.
Right. And for those of you who missed our last episode, it centered around the remains of a human being who died 12,000 years ago because he got shot in the upper neck or in the neck area with a quartz arrow and then survived, had a bone infection, horrible way to die 12,000 years ago. And the researcher spent 7 years of his life putting that story together, this from a cave in Vietnam to all of us today.
And there were moments during that 7 year span of work where that work was possibly tedious.
Tedious.
Thank you, Ernie. That's exactly what I was looking for.
Tedious. Although the researcher himself, Ben, said, yeah, it can be boring, but tedious is the better word.
We also have an email here from Louise, and this is so nice. I have to read this. I am so very pleased to have found you, Connor and Gabe. Science was never easy for me in school, and you have made all that change. Your voices, your interaction with each other, your humor, and your humanity. Your research and clear analysis have helped me cope with many a sleepless night.
Wow.
I'm very grateful, Louise.
Thank you, Louise. Our studio technician is clapping his
hands.
Can
you believe this?
as he hears this.
Yeah. And then she finishes the email. She says, cheers, Louise. And then says, P.S., if you get a chance, have a look at the diabetic man who had a genetically engineered cell transplant that enables him now to produce his own insulin. We talked a little bit about this a couple weeks back or about a month ago.
Louise,
I don't know if you caught that episode. If you didn't, there's a little bit more to say about that unbelievable breakthrough out of a Swedish university, Uppsala University up in Sweden, in conjunction with an American cell engineering company, Sana Biotechnologies. Here's the latest, and we're going to hear right now one of the main doctors out of Uppsala University in Sweden.
Det här är ju en första studie för att se en proof of concept.
You had me at proof of concept. I thought
So that's Per-Ola Carlson involved in this experiment, and it's a 42-year-old Swede who was a diabetic since age 5. Got this donation of islet cells in his beta cells in his pancreas that produce insulin. For type 1 diabetes, they don't work. They don't work at all. You don't produce any insulin.
Oh yeah, you mean typically. If you have type 1 diabetes.
Right. Yeah. So this 42-year-old got this donation of cells and now he's producing insulin, but the big part about the experiment, the breakthrough, is that his body didn't immediately reject those cells. That's what happens with organ donation or cell donation. Your immune system kills it off because it's foreign. And what they did, what Per-Ola Carlson is explaining in this experiment, is that they made 3 different edits to the cells, 2 of which to tell the cell it's not an antigen, it's nothing foreign, and also one last one to turn down that killer instinct of the immune system. And when all 3 of those edits were applied to these cells, they work. It's a proof of concept, what he said there. The guy still needs insulin, and this is the mistake that I said last time, that he's cured. This guy is cured. Absolutely not the case. He only got 7% of the cells that you would need, of the beta cells that you would need to be cured.
Oh.
Because it was only proof of concept. So they weren't trying to cure him. They were just trying to show if we make these 3 edits to these cells, the immune system will not reject them and you will not need immunosuppressive drugs. And they have done that and it works. And now, as Per-Ola Carlson there says at the end in Swedish, the next step is not using actual donor cells from somebody who has died, but using stem cells, because then the sky's the limit.
Then you can create huge batches of them.
Endless amount of cells, and there are endless amount of number of diabetics in the world, and everyone with type 1 diabetes will theoretically be able to be cured this way.
Right. So all they're doing there is putting it inside him and saying, is your immune system going to attack and kill all these new cells? They yeah. didn't. He's safe. He's healthy.
He is still safe. The cells still work. Only the 7%, obviously, but they still work. And it's going along as planned.
Yeah, that's
it's unbelievable news.
Great news. But an important update or kind of qualification or contextualization of what has happened and what will happen in the future.
Yeah.
I'm going to go big on babies right now.
Okay.
Babies. and specifically right now about when babies cry. Obviously, babies aren't able to talk. They don't have human language yet. Mm-hmm. And so if they need something, if they need help, they make cries, but different kinds of cries for different kinds of things.
Okay.
And that's their way of alerting any adult who's close by, hey, come over here, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's interesting about this study is that it was looking at kind of the acoustic. It did a couple things, but first it started with the acoustic properties of those cries, because when a baby cries, it's sort of a different – you can see that it's different than other sounds. So our listeners out there are going to have to visualize this. When you see a sound as a wave file, these waves are symmetrical. It goes up one way and down the same way. And it's mm-hmm. if you put a mirror on both sides, it's the same on both sides.
Amplitude, yeah.
Yeah. A non-linear phenomenon means it's not symmetrical. It goes up one way and goes down a different way. That's a specific acoustic signal. And what that acoustic signal does is it causes us adults to react in an autonomic nervous reaction. Our bodies are going to react to that, and we cannot help it. We're not.
So we're automatons. It's like a robotic reaction to this distinct sound pattern.
Correct. And to kind of not prove it, but show it so you can listen to it. Just a warning for the people out there who don't like baby cries.
I don't.
Yeah. I'm going to play two of them here. And these are from the study itself. These are the sounds of baby cries used in the study. And I want you to, as you listen, try to feel if you feel a physical reaction at all to these two sounds. Yeah, Gabe just jumped away from, almost jumped out of your chair to that second one.
Yeah. It reminds me of my brother. When we would bring our kids back home and my brother heard that, he would leave the room.
Yeah.
Just hated the sound.
But it's okay to hate it. Everyone out there, if you're one of those people like, I hate this, that's fine, because it's causing an uncontrollable reaction in your body that you can't help. So of course you want to get away from it. But yeah, what they did is they took adults and thermally watched their faces change. And without them knowing, being able to control it, you could see the heat rise in their faces. And importantly, it was equal in men and women.
Ah.
We physically react exactly the same way, thermally.
So you're measuring the temperature of people's faces while they listen to these sounds?
Yes. And to kind of quote the end here of the paper, the pain encoded in a baby's cry thus generates a synchronized emotional response in both adult men and women, emphasizing that our ability to decode the information carried by baby's cries integrates an immediate activation of the autonomic nervous system before engaging any higher order cognitive processes. Now, I think I first came across a study in an article written by The Guardian, to give full credit to them. And they also linked to a study that was published 1 month earlier, so 1 month ago now. And this was on babies' cries when basically you're trying to sleep at night and a baby cries. There's this cliche, some of you might have heard it before. Mm. Oh, hey, babe, sorry, I didn't wake up during the night to help the baby because I didn't hear the baby.
Yeah.
Right? We men kind of get away with that.
Yeah. Use that as an excuse is more, yeah. probably more closer to the truth.
Yeah. So the Danish study was looking into that. Is that actually true? They took 150 people, and the important part here is they're not parents yet.
Purists.
They're pure people, pure adults. They put them in a sleep lab, and first they tried a low volume baby cry. That's 33 to 44 decibels. That's roughly the sound of a whisper or soft music or a babbling brook. In that scenario, women were 14% more likely to wake up.
More likely. Okay.
More likely. And that seems like a pretty pure result, because it's not, they don't have children yet. They're not really in that alarm state of parenthood where you're like, oh, I have to listen for any sound, mm-hmm. right? 14%. Now, if the sound is higher than that, there is no difference. Okay. Men wake up at the same rate. So there I would assume it's kind of like, you know, these cribs that you can attach to the side of a bed, these nest cribs. If the child's that close, you're going to wake up the same way. Now, part two of the study, they asked real parents, could you, you know, fill out a diary and tell us who actually gets up? And in that case, big surprise, women were, or mothers in this case, were three times more likely to get up and check on or respond than fathers. In about a quarter of those cases, both partners did things equally. Mm-hmm. But so that cliche is still socially true. That is what's happening in the real world. But the idea that it's because men aren't waking up at the same rate or aren't physically reacting to these stimuli is not true.
Not as true. But yeah, there still is, in some cases, especially when the baby is quiet, science that would back you up if you're using that as an excuse, 14% more likely that you won't.
Oh, yeah. If you want that excuse, less likely that you'll hear it. I'm really sorry I didn't wake up, but it was at the babbling brook level. Part of the reason I paid attention to this, I was already fascinated. And then the lead author of that first one on the acoustic signals, Nicolas Matevon.
Matevon.
Does that ring a bell for you? This is a guy we've been trying to, we're going to interview him at some point. He's a French researcher.
The bird guy.
Yeah. So a little background here. We at Deutsche Welle at the Science Desk, we get books sent to us for free. Yeah. In the hopes, the publishers hope that we'll talk about them on the air.
Wait a minute, Voices of Nature? Is that what
yeah.
it is?
Yeah. And one in particular jumped out at me, and I emailed him, and I've been trying. We're going to interview him, but the last time we tried to go interview him, we were going to go down to France and talk to him. He sent an email back, and he's like, oh, hey, sorry, but I'm off to Mozambique to do something with hippos. And then I'm off to the island of La Réunion, if I'm saying that horribly in French.
Sounded pretty good.
To do something with birds. And then here, I was going to try to talk to him again. And he's like, I'm really sorry. I'm in Denmark for a bioacoustics conference. This guy's everywhere. But yeah, that was his study, that very first one.
We're going to go to the United States of America for this one. And the topic is dark. Political violence. I don't know if you can, if it's possible to avoid that concept or that idea right now based on, or because of what happened in the last couple of weeks, the brutal murder of Charlie Kirk, right-wing podcaster, influencer. This study was looking at stereotypes. Stereotypes and the extent to which they, or how much they play in whether you're going to endorse political violence. This is a study out of UC Davis, University of California, Davis. This is an ongoing project that they're looking into. And one of the surveys that they're using in their project looked at or asked 10,000 people in the summer of 2023, average age 49 years old, half-half men, women, 60% identifying as white, to look at two different sets of statements. The first ones are essentially stereotypes: homophobia, transphobia, xenophobia, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and hostile sexism. And based on whether you agreed with those statements.
Statements that would have.
Let me just, I'll give you some examples. Okay, so if I agree with gay men and lesbian women should stop shoving their lifestyle down other people's throats.
Okay.
That's one. For transphobia.
Well, hold on. Let me cut you off because I feel we risk even hearing those words.
But this was the study.
Yeah. No, I know. No. Yes. But so homophobic, racist, transphobic statements and it was just about whether or not you agreed with those statements.
Yeah. Do you agree with that statement? And there's a list of, I won't read them. There's all kinds of sentences that I could read on the air. I probably definitely should not read them. Okay.
Well, because hearing those phobic statements, even though at the intellectual level you reject them, our listeners, I firmly believe, will reject them. At some level, just having them slammed into your head enough can also kind of shift you in a way that nobody wants.
It's going to have an effect based on the results of the study. It's going to have an effect on whether you agree with the next set of statements. And this is political violence. So statements like true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. The United States needs a civil war to set things right. Violence is justified to stop an election from being stolen. there is a connection. It was way bigger than I thought. If you believe the first phobia statements, or if you support those statements, the likelihood that you will support the second set of statements goes up to almost 50%, somewhere between 12.5% and 50%. It's more likely that you will endorse, support political violence if you believe those first ones.
So for listeners out there, if you hear any of those phobic statements, you can, based on this study, assume that there's a correlation between that person the condoning of political violence.
The study, if you want to read it, Fear, Loathing, and Support for Political Violence in the United States, Findings from a Nationally Representative Survey is the title of the study, and it's in The Lancet.
We're running out of clock here, but I have to sneak something in because we had a listener write in with a great link to a great study that was also on babies, and I would feel amiss without at least mentioning it. Mm. This was I'll do it real quick and dirty here. It was done on the east coast of Sicily, that island off of Italy. 36 babies, and they wanted to know, do they prefer moral things or immoral things?
Babies.
And then I looked, these babies in the experiment were 5 days old. And they were going to show them 60-second video clips. I'm like, what? How well do their eyes work at 5 days old? Well, what videos?
Milk? Isn't that what they're looking for at that point? Not morality?
Long story short, there were three different studies. They were watching gray balls either move toward each other or away from each other, meaning the gray balls have agency. They're like a human kind of. Mm-hmm. And they tracked how long do these babies watch these things. And when the balls kind of moved toward each other in a pro-social way, as opposed to antisocial, or helped each other instead of hindering each other, the babies watched that more. So babies, some of the articles talking about this were like, oh, babies prefer morality. Mm-hmm. Well, they pay attention to pro-social behavior more than antisocial. That's what you can say. Yeah. Interesting study out of Italy. And if you can just hang with us for a minute.
I was going to say, that's one way to interpret morality. There's another, we're going to be thinking about morality more in the second half of the show, right when we come back. Please keep listening.
Yeah. Okay, so we are going to stay in Italy, where we ended, but we're going to move from Sicily to Bologna, and specifically to the oldest university in the world. 1088 was when the University of Bologna was created, founded. Mm. And I want all of our listeners to imagine you're a student sitting in this storied institution, and you're about to attend a lecture on philosophy. You're going to hear two voices giving the same lecture. I've kind of mixed them in a recreation of the actual experiment. And I'm going to ask you afterwards which one you preferred.
What is glory? In its true meaning, it is an excess, an overabundance, and this is an effect. But what are the causes that operate or bring about this effect? There are three: virtue, communication, and duration. Let me explain. There are three axes, or three parameters, to this concept. The first is what I would call the shining excellence of the work.
And that implies virtue, in the sense of having the ability to produce a work and orient it toward a value. So the work must be oriented toward a value. It must be excellent. It's not a new Guinness World Record. It's not the person who eats the biggest hunk of mortadella or salami in the world. That person has no glory. Glory is something that has to do with the virtue.
Okay, so those were two lectures.
Same lecture.
Same exact text,
yeah,
but read by different voices.
Yeah, a little dry.
Which one did I like more? Or which
that's,
one?
That's, yeah, and before we answer it, I'm going to let the author of the study herself explain to all of us that, unfortunately, there's a really clear and somewhat unfair answer.
Science Unscripted. My name is Pia Campegiani, and I am an associate professor of moral philosophy at the University of Bologna. With two colleagues in cognitive science and in psychology, I carried out a study on gender biases in student evaluations of their professors. Students, even those with progressive attitudes and explicit beliefs that are egalitarian, consistently give higher ratings to lecturers when they think that the professor is a man.
How did they rate them differently?
Well, the lecturers were actually identical. So the only difference was the voice, and that is very important because it allowed us to isolate the variable of gender. So they rated professors and texts on different dimensions, which were clarity, benefit in terms of learning, how the text was interesting and the lecture was interesting, whether they perceived the professor as self-confident, and whether they thought the professor cared about their students. So the results were that men professors, or when the participants thought the professors were men, rated them much higher across all dimensions except for the dimension of care.
So let's hold on. That's a lot of things that you just mentioned. For if it's a male voice I'm listening to, it's more clear, it's more beneficial, it's more interesting, but I don't think that that person cares as much about me. Is that what you learned in your study?
Yeah, well, they didn't think that the men professors wouldn't care about them. They thought that women professors would just care more. So basically what we had was a representation of the typical stereotype. High prestige job, I expect it to be a man, the ideal performer of that job. So in terms of competence, self-confidence, clarity in the explanation, how interesting it is, I rate men higher than women.
What was the response from some of your colleagues to these results? I'm assuming that in your department, you're one of the few women. Can I assume that at this point as a professor of moral philosophy from what you're saying?
Yes, you can. So actually, in moral philosophy, I'm the only woman. And in general, in my department, full professors are women only for 1/4. So the question is tricky because I can say I will remain general, but I can say I did encounter a little bit of resistance in my department when it came up that I was carrying out this study. But, you know, I was raised in Italy as a woman, so I'm used to people telling me, no, you shouldn't do that, and I've become stubborn. So I just bang my head against the wall until I make a hole.
How does it feel to know that in your job, in your profession, you are going to be rated lower in these categories? No matter what you do, even if you do it in exactly the same way as your male counterpart, that you will be rated lower?
Well, it makes me angry, obviously. It makes me angry, especially retrospectively, because I'm a grown up. I've had the opportunity to study. So I was one of the lucky ones. And so I know how it works. And my self-esteem is not really destroyed or imperiled by this situation, or not so much. But when I was younger, I did have problems with my self-esteem precisely because I got this feedback from society that no matter what I did and no matter how well I did it, I was never as good as my male peers. So that can be a real problem and obstacle to the flourishing of young women.
I'm just curious, this is at the anecdotal level, obviously, in your case, but what is that feeling that you have that male and female students behave differently with you than male professors? What is it specifically?
Well, for example, I mean, I can give you an anecdote of something that happened quite recently. I teach an introductory course to moral philosophy. And this, because we have very many students in Bologna, this course is divided into two blocks. The colleague who teaches the other block is a man colleague. And sometimes we exchange lectures. So I go and teach in his course and he comes and teach at my course. And every time he comes to my course, my students, even though we introduce each other and I am an associate professor, he is in a slightly lower academic rank, so he's a doctor, officially speaking, they still swap the titles. So they take it for granted that he is the professor, I am his assistant, even if we've just told them that it is the other way around. So that's quite telling.
Knowing what you do now, as a professor in Italy, do you ever think, boy, I should leave Italy?
Sometimes I'm tempted, but no, I want to stay. I have a little niece now who I love very much, and she's really a motivating force. I want to do work in this direction. I'm also training in philosophy for children, so I would like to go to schools to volunteer to teach young children from primary school about gender biases and try to give my little contribution to make the life of little girls happier and less difficult.
That was Pia Campagiani speaking to us from Bologna, Italy.
Yeah, and I guess we kind of left that on an unproductive note. I mean, this is a problem that has been identified and now discussed through Pia's study. What do you do about it? Mm. What can you do? It feels overwhelming. The closest I have to an answer to that, and we discussed this with Pia at one point, is a study. It isn't the same thing, but where jurors, or in this case, potential jurors, this was all done via survey, 400 people back in 2015, and they were about to look at evidence and determine a guilt judgment. Is the person I'm reading about, how guilty are they? How long should they go to jail? Mm-hmm. And in that study, what they did is they told jurors, like, hey, look, just real quick, before you start, there's a bias that every juror has based on race. And if the person who may or may not go to jail has a certain skin color, you might give them a harsher judgment as a result. Just be aware of that.
They were told this before they formed their judgment.
Yes, and the study was more complex. They had various ways of telling them this or not telling them to see what is the result. And one way in particular, I'll just read it here, they said, making race salient in the courtroom and tailoring instructions to egalitarianism are likely to be effective in reducing biases. So basically prompting them, telling them that this is a problem that you may have, helped them to be more fair. The closest I can come, I guess, to something good that could come out of this study is that when they have these websites in the English-speaking world, Rate My Professor, where you rate your professor afterwards. If there was a way to let students, university students, know, hey, you tend to be a little unfair, you tend to be sexist when you do this, be aware of that, and now give your judgment or give, you know, 5 stars or 3 stars or 4, however they do it, that would kind of help, maybe.
There are different levels of resistance when it comes to stereotypes. We were talking about stereotypes at the beginning of this show with regard to political violence and the extent to which you would support it based on how deeply you believe in stereotypes or would support them. And the researchers in that study were saying that these kinds of stereotypes, or those kinds of stereotypes, there's high resistance to them. And in some cases, there's nothing you can do about it. They're so entrenched in their beliefs that there is nothing you can do about it. But it's a good thing that these kinds of stereotypes, it sounds from that study you just quoted from Yale, is that they can be changed. That is a very good thing.
Yeah. If you want to look into it, it's called Mitigating Jurors' Racial Biases, the Effects of Content and Timing of Jury Instructions. Take a look yourself. But between now and then, what do you think? Do you have anything to say? We've covered a lot of ground here talking about political violence, babies, all sorts of things, sexism. Let us know what you're thinking. SU@dw.com.
DW, made for minds.